This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and I'm Randy Alfred. On this morning's show, we'll talk to Elizabeth A. Lynn, the lesbian author of The Dancers of Erin, a gay male science fiction love story. And by popular demand, we bring you White Knight, Black Dish, or the ultimate last fag joke, an irreverent musical about the ex-cop who killed Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone. The song we started with was Angel with a Key by Camille O'Grady. We played it this morning as a memorial to Bob Opel, an associate of Camille's who was murdered in his Fayway Galleries in San Francisco on Sunday, July 8th. Who killed Bob Opel? The police say it was a drug-related holdup, and they captured three suspects. Yet, one of them just walked out of the courtroom the other morning while no one was looking. Did the murder of Bob Opel have anything to do with his politics? Did it have anything to do with his outrageousness? On Gay Freedom Day, Sunday, June 24th, Bob put on a guerrilla theater piece in UN Plaza called The Execution of Dan White. He asked, what would happen if a queer, gay, pervert, faggot, shot and killed an ex-cop? Would he get away with murder? Bob and Camille were guests on The Gay Life in April. Let's listen to what Bob had to say then about the politics of outrageousness and the politics of sex in San Francisco.
What do you think of the current political situation in the city vis-a-vis the politics of sex?
Well, sort of backlash now, I think, just like became very liberal, very open, and then all of a sudden the assassinations happened, and now it seems like there's this kind of tendency to be very sort of strict and rigid. You have a new administration that seems to have sort of kind of a puritanical streak behind it, and I think it's real stupid, real dangerous, and real idiotic, and I think that it's necessary to continue to push the boundaries and not try to go backwards, and I feel that's what's happening now. But I don't think it'll happen. It won't get very far because it's just you can't ever really kind of go backwards, I don't think, or close the doors back again. It just doesn't work.
Well, I'm just very curious to see how they're going to try and pull that off in this city when there's so many gay people in it, because they definitely are coming down very hard on everyone, and everybody's very nervous.
But do you think the gay community collectively is willing to defend its places of essentially what are sexual assignation places?
Well,
off the street.
Sure, I hope so. I hope so, because I think that one of the things that always seemed to me that the gay society or the gay culture, whatever, seemed to be uptight about was like the sexual aspect. And I was always kind of like out there on the fringes to sort of remind everybody that, you know, this is the way we are sexual and so on. And I was always kind of, people were always kind of embarrassed about me because I've gotten into trouble periodically for being more overtly sexual or calling attention to that aspect of our nature. So I hope so, but I certainly will continue to be, you know, out there on that frontier or that you know, pushing that.
Well, I think less and less should be less and less of a threat simply because of the numbers of people. Now, I know they're, you know, as you go backwards, there'd be less and less people are willing to come out and say, yes, you know, we should rally about this. And, you know, it's been sort of insidious because since I've been here, I've watched places sort of one by one be closed down. And I think it's going to get much worse. And I think that, I mean, when they had the assassination, all the people came out and were very obvious about their feelings and their proclivities and so on, and I think that nothing should be allowed to be pulled on this city.
At the same time that this kind of sexuality that we're talking about where, well, for instance, a lot of the artwork at Fayway, especially the current gallery, the current exhibit, deals a lot with authority figures. There are fantasies of sex with cops and
right.
firemen and
yeah.
Several other type figures like that. At the same yeah. time that it's a form of sexuality, which is in fact, in many respects, even a minority inside the gay sexual minority, and a form that kind of has an artistic avant-garde edge to it in playing with authority, works around a lot about submitting to authority.
Yes, that's true, but it's like fantasy, you know, fantasy and reality too. You know, it's like these fantasies about being dominated by the police or whatever, about being forced into some kind of sexual situation and so on. That, you know, is a heavy, heavy fantasy trip. And of course, when you actually do translate it into reality, you know, I don't think anybody's really suggesting that people be put into these roles in a real situation where we really seek to be dominated by the police or that is I don't think so. It's a fantasy situation, you know.
It's working it out sexually instead yeah. of having it happen to you in real life.
Yeah, yeah.
The artist is Domino, who's
currently showing.
Yeah,
they're involved.
There's two artists. In the
yeah, I have two artists showing. It's a joint show with Domino and an artist named Rick Borg, who is more intellectual in a way, uses a certain sexual symbols in a more intellectual way.
Right,
Beardsley-esque sort of things, you know.
Right, also there's a certain op art
right.
overtone in it. Right. Which of the two artists did the Dirty Talk cartoon?
Oh, that's Domino.
That's why I said it was. He was the one who has all the cops and things.
Yeah. I always felt that artsy somehow is out of the realm of the area of where, you know, you can come down on that and say, well, you can't show this because this is pornography, which is, of course, an absurd idea anyway. But that was created by the courts to sort of indicate an area that wasn't protected by the First Amendment because it dealt with sex exclusively. And you had to have some other kind of redeeming social quality. You couldn't just be into sex for sex because you had to do it for some other reason, which is idiotic. But art sort of transcends that, you know, puts it in a sort of an enshrined category. But it is an interesting test that, you know, if people, the police ever did come and try to close it down, I would be willing to defend it on that level. Although my feeling is that anything should be seen anyway, you know, that censorship is absurd. So, you know, but I've never experienced any problems here in the city.
The words of the late conceptual artist Robert Opel when he was a guest on KSAN's The Gay Life in April of this year. We replayed those remarks for you so that you might get a better understanding of why Bob Opel may have died. And while you're thinking about that, we'll start talking to our first guest this morning, Elizabeth A. Lynn, the author of the fantasy trilogy The Chronicles of Tornor and the novel A Different Light. A Different Light is actually the earlier book, isn't it, Liz?
Yes, it is, Randy.
And good morning and welcome to KSAN and The Gay Life.
Thank you.
You dragged yourself away from writing the third book of the trilogy. I dragged myself away from reading the second book of the trilogy, which I must say is spellbinding. I had actually intended to skim through it rapidly and have it finished before we talked this morning, and I couldn't do it. I got into it and just had to go with its natural rhythm, and don't tell the ending, not only for the sake of our listeners, but for me, because I've got what looks like it's going to be a fun-filled and dynamite final 40 or 50 pages.
I'm really glad you're enjoying it.
In the second volume of the Chronicles trilogy, The Dancers of Arran, there's a very natural acceptance both of sexual equality between women and men and of gay love, with gay love being one of the major themes that operates throughout it. Yet you don't make a big point of it and say, look, here it is, and point at it. It's there.
This is something that seems to me to be really important for my own writing. I'm not about to judge the way anyone else handles theme or character or plot. But in writing science fiction and in writing fantasy, I like to write about the worlds that I would like to see, or perhaps the worlds that I would like to have been in. Arran is an imaginary country, and I like to say about Chronicles that it's really historical fiction about an imaginary country. It's a variation on Western Europe, a very particular variation. There's no church, for instance. And it might have been interesting had we all grown up with the easy acceptance of each other's sexuality and grown up with a non-sexist culture. At any rate, I liked to portray it there because I miss it. It would have been very valuable.
I think you just said one of the key words, which is culture. I would regard it almost more as a fictional anthropology than a fictional history. There's tremendous attention paid to the customs and folkways and kinship patterns.
Well, I think you're really splitting hairs, because how can you write history without writing about such things? It's part of what history is.
In The Dancers of Arran, there's considerable amount is based on relationships of teaching, of one culture teaching another, of a student, almost of a teacher teaching a student, almost a shaman acolyte relationship I see somewhere. You've taught yourself.
Yes.
And what kind of carryover is there in that?
I'd like to take that one step farther rather than talking about myself and talk about the fact that the teaching relationship is one of the basic relationships of human life, it seems to me. We teach our children. We teach adolescents, and they teach us. We teach each other. And it's an unacknowledged theme in love stories that love is taught. And part of the delight of love is teaching each other. It was an old theme in Greece that the homosexual love in the Grecian world was particularly an older man and a younger man, and the older man was seen as teacher. I don't think this is such a bad thing to go back to as a theme, and I tried to put it in The Dancers of Erin.
Another of the themes besides the love of a teacher for student and vice versa is the love of two brothers.
Yes.
So that you're dealing in a way not only with a gay love story, but it's one that our culture, for instance, would consider an incestuous gay love story.
I guess so. I find that a little difficult to understand. It's very clear in the book that the brothers haven't seen each other in something like 10 years and have had no brotherly contact at all. On the other hand...
Save for the psychic one.
Right, right. On the other hand, I was going to go on to say, it does reappear, but not in any of the traditional family senses that we see. I'm not supporting incest within the family, because I think it's mostly coercive. But I think I have described a non-coercive relationship.
Right, and it really is as if they were cousins. That is, they understand that they're kin, but have been raised separately due to the history of warfare.
Right.
Actually. When Karis, who is the main character, if not one of the main characters, I would say the main character.
He's the protagonist. He's the point of view character. You see what's going on through his head.
When he discovers that he is a witch, that he has special powers, I felt as if there was a sensitivity in the way he discovered it, in the way he has to come to understand it, as if it was a model for coming out.
Wow. Well, I hadn't thought of it that way at all, but you put your life into your books and into your stories, and I guess I certainly put a portion of myself into Kel and Karis's relationship. When I wrote that book...
Kel is the older brother, I'll explain to the listeners. So,
when I wrote that book, and the original portion of that book was written in 1971, I should say, when that portion was written, I was in love. And so I hope a lot of the emotion that I was feeling then exists in the novel. I sure hope so.
I certainly felt it. So another one of the major themes that gets carried through, at least in The Dancers of Erin, and I would imagine through the rest of the trilogy, is the development of special powers, the so-called witch powers, and not only of individuals but as a community. Mm-hmm. Of people with special powers. We find people who can perceive patterns, people who can read minds, people who can move physical things, telekinesis, people who can change the weather, people who can travel to distant places.
People
and
who can heal.
People who can heal.
Yes.
Those are your seven categories. But in most of the Western European witchcraft and magical traditions that actually exist, these kind of powers are found in solitary groups rather than in communities.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that has to do with, I don't mean to be anti-clerical here, but I'm going to be, the influence of the Catholic Church in Western Europe. In Erin, there is no church, and I don't want to give anything away, but I will say that in The Northern Girl, which is the third book of the trilogy, the book I'm writing now...
The book you were writing before you dashed down to the studio.
Right.
The book you will write when you return.
in that book, the witches develop into an institution which in many ways begins to resemble a church. I don't want to say that I think that such powers are necessarily good, and of course I don't think they're necessarily evil. I think it's interesting to see what a particular culture chooses to do with them, and I'm not going to say any more because you're going to have to read the book.
Okay. Continuing on with this analogy of coming out into witchcraft and coming out into gaydom,
mm-hmm.
there's a town called Aeloth which accepts its witches, which in fact seems to honor them.
Yes.
is there a parallel to San Francisco? And
I guess there is, though. When I first envisioned that town, I'd never been to San Francisco. But I had the same kind of reaction to San Francisco that Karis has to Elath, that feeling of coming home, of being in the right place. San Francisco was an extremely important place for me when I got here, and it hasn't stopped being that. I love the city.
Is there... Well, I'm not sure how to ask this next question precisely, because... let me hold off on it. What's A Different Light about?
A Different Light is about an artist who is dying, and there are not very many people in his culture who die of cancer at 30. That's his problem. As a result of this, his art is blocked. He can't work. And the story is about what happens to him when he chooses to do something which he knows will eventually kill him in order to go out and do his art. It's a science fiction book. It's not a fantasy book at all, and it's got all those things beloved of science fiction readers, you know, interesting little technologies and other planets and hyperspace, ta-da! And I had a great deal of fun writing it. I had the odd experience recently of going back and reading it because I was speaking to a class about it and found to my surprise that, yeah, okay, I could live with that book, even though it was written, whatever, 4 or 5 years ago. And there were things in it that I would not probably do the same now because I know more about writing now than I did when I wrote it. But basically I find myself pretty pleased with it.
At the same time that you mention all of these technologies and different planets and hyperspace, aren't those really all always just foils in good science fiction? I mean, there is a tradition of science fiction that's simply
there are people who
space
make,
opera.
Who make that right. Their whole story.
But the science fiction I enjoy reading is the one that is really about the interaction of peoples with technologies.
Well, this book is space opera. A Different Light is space opera, and I had fun writing it that way. Of course, it's got people in it, too. That's the difference, you see. It's got a star captain who's even got red hair, and he's a thief, sort of. And it's got all kinds of interesting people in it, and some of them are deliberate, on my part, send-ups of standard space opera plots. But I think the book stands on its own. But I'd be the first to say, sure, it's a space opera. Why not? I like space opera. Space opera's fun.
Is science fiction and fantasy as a genre a safer place for people to write about a freely expressed sexuality than other forms of fiction? Is it safer for you?
That's not why I write it, I don't think. No, I don't understand how the word safe applies. I think it's a more interesting place. The nice thing about science fiction and fantasy is that you can get outside the patriarchal culture so that you can write about feminist themes and you can write about gay women and you can write about gay men and you don't have to invent a little artificial place inside the world we live in. You go right outside it. You jump outside and say, okay, folks, get on this spaceship and we'll take you to an interesting place or get on this fantasy dragon and we'll take you to an interesting place where we can talk seriously about a world that does not, at present, exist within our own.
Right. You haven't really replaced a patriarchy with a matriarchy either, which has been the theme of a number of interesting speculative novels and so forth. Yet it almost seems as if the head women in the heads of all the villages are women, and
yes.
Yet the castles, the fortresses, are still these male institutions. Or is that just a misperception?
No, you've hit on something thematic to the book. Castles and fortresses do tend to be rather male institutions, and I think that, without wanting to give anything away again, she said, hopefully. I think that castles and fortresses are only one kind of culture and one kind of interaction, and one of our misconceptions of history is that it's the most important kind. In the third book, all the point of view characters are women, and this makes for an interesting contrast, I think, with the two previous novels.
Oh-ho, it's got that comment just set my mind thinking, now where is this all going to lead? Where does it lead in terms of you've got to also have a commitment or a manuscript in for another science fiction book that,
yes, I do.
That follows a different light.
It's called The Sardonyx Net, and it's set in the same fictional universe as A Different Light, and it'll be out sometime in the middle of 1980, though I don't know when, from Berkeley Putnam.
So where it lead, your career is leading, is definitely leading on to bigger and better things all the time. The Dancers of Aaron was just recently published.
Right. In fact, officially, its publication date hasn't happened yet.
Oh-ho. Maybe that's why I could find it in one store and not in another one. But and the first volume of the trilogy is again, just about six months old or so. So
it
that it's,
came out in February,
so
I guess.
So things are happening very rapidly.
Yes. The Northern Girl is scheduled for a February publication, February 1980. I don't know what I'm doing sitting here talking to you. I got to go back and finish this novel.
Well, you also have to go around to some bookstores and have some signing parties for this book, which would give people who've just begun to get a sense of how fascinating a person Elizabeth A. Lynn is from this
That's
interview.
That's me blushing.
To meet you in person. When and where can people meet you at these signing parties?
There are going to be two signing parties. The first one is the 21st July, Saturday, in the afternoon. I think the time is 2 to 4, at Dark Carnival Bookstore on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley. And the second one is the next Saturday, July 28th, again in the afternoon from 1 to 3, and that's going to be at the Walt Whitman Bookstore here in San Francisco.
On Sutter Street?
On Sutter Street.
Okay, now why don't we repeat those both, because while you were saying that, someone had to go and run and get their pen and paper.
Right. Okay, folks. The first autograph party, and I hope I see you there, will be July 21st at Dark Carnival Bookstore on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley in the afternoon. The second autograph party will be on July 28th at the Walt Whitman Bookstore here in San Francisco, again in the afternoon from 1 to 3. And while it is, theoretically, it is for the Dancers of Aaron, I hope that both bookstores will have copies of Watchtower on hand and A Different Light and some of the places where I've had short fiction.
Right. And Watchtower, The Dancers of Aaron, and A Different Light are all published by Berkeley.
A Different Light is a Berkeley paperback. Watchtower and The Dancers of Aaron are Berkeley Putnam hardcovers, and The Northern Girl will be also. But they'll all be out in paperback next year.
But in the meantime, get them in hardcover.
Thank you.
Get your famous first editions and get them signed. This has been a fascinating time. I hope we'll be able to have you back perhaps when the third novel comes out, and I will catch up with the entire. Thank you, Elizabeth A. Lynn.
Thank you very much, Randy. It's been fun.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN. And by an unusual chain of circumstances, we're covering parts of the stories of three different murders on this show. First, on July 3rd, Dan White was sentenced for the killings of Supervisor Harvey Milk and George Moscone. And later in the show, we'll be bringing you a rebroadcast of White Knight, Black Dish. On July 8th, Bob Opel was murdered in his South of Market Fayway Gallery, and we played you some of the interview that we did with Bob in April of this year. And on July 11th, the California Court of Appeals for the First Appellate District turned down the appeal by John Cordova of his conviction in 1977 for the murder of Robert Hillsborough. That was the murder which took place on June 22nd, shortly before Gay Freedom Day, and only weeks after the Anita Bryant victory in Miami. Cordova was tried in November and December of 1977 and was convicted of second-degree murder. He was sentenced in January of 1978, and his lawyer, George Walker, appealed the case to the state's Court of Appeal, alleging that Superior Court Judge Donald Constein had made certain errors in his conduct of the trial. The state Court of Appeal, in a unanimous decision of 3-0, ruled that the errors were not significant and in fact, in one case, did not exist at all. One of the interesting things about the decision is that it's a very strong decision. It essentially incorporates
the version of facts alleged by the state attorney general in his response to the appeal, and that it was written by Judge Paul Halvonik of the First Appellate Court. And Halvonik is generally considered to be a civil libertarian, extending to defendants all of the a very liberal interpretation of what their rights as defendants are. John Cordova was sentenced to a sentence of 5 years to life under the old Indeterminate Sentencing Act, and his attorney expects that under the new determinate sentencing law that Cordova will serve approximately 6 years, although he may get up to a third of that off for good behavior. That would mean that he might serve from 1977 when he was arrested to about 1981. Tom Spooner, one of the other assailants in the fatal attack on Robert Hillsborough, was found guilty in a February 1978 trial of aggravated assault and was sentenced to 6 months to 15 years for aggravated assault. Under the determinate sentencing law, his sentence was changed, and he now has a prospective release date of September 25th of 1979, which would give him a total time served from his arrest of 27 months. On July 3rd, Superior Court Judge Walter Calcagno sentenced Dan White to 7 2/3 years in state prison for the slayings of Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone. If he lives that long, Dan White will be eligible for release from prison after serving 2/3 of the 7 2/3 years. That will be the first week of 1984. The exact date is January 6th, Epiphany, the Feast of the Three Kings, the 12th day of Christmas. 1984, 12th night, the release of Dan White. It brings to mind the words of the great poet William Butler Yeats in The Second Coming. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. And now, by popular demand, The Gay Life rebroadcasts White Night, Black Dish, or The Ultimate Last Fag Joke, first heard on KSAN on June 3rd and 5th, 1979.
Williams and Zinger killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore hotel society gathering. And the cops was called in and his weapon took from him as they rolled him in custody down to the station and booked Williams and Zinger for first-degree murder. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. Williams and Zinger, who had 24 years, owns a tobacco farm of 600 acres with rich, wealthy parents who provide and protect him, and high office relations in the politics of Maryland reacted to his deed with a shrug of his shoulders and swear words and sneering, and his tongue it was a snarling. And in a matter of minutes, on bail was out walking. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. Hattie Carroll was a maid in the kitchen. She was 51 years old and gave birth to 10 children who carried the dishes and took out the garbage and never sat once at the head of the table and didn't even talk to the people at the table. who just cleaned up all the food from the table and emptied the ashtrays on a whole other level, got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane that sailed through the air and came down through the room, doomed and determined to destroy all the gentle. And she never done nothing to Williams and Zinger. And you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. The judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level and that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded and that even the nobles get properly handled once that the cops have chased after and caught 'em and that the ladder of law has no top and no bottom. Stared at the person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning. And he spoke through his cloak most deep and distinguished and handed out strongly for penalty and repentance Williams and Zinger with a 6-month sentence. How about you? Philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears. Bury the rain deep in your face, for now's the time for your tears.
The Gay Life on KSAN presents White Night, Black Dish, or The Ultimate Last Fag Joke. On a rainy day in January 1978, gay leader Harvey Milk is sworn in as a supervisor of the city and county of San Francisco.
Mom, who's in that picture?
That's that faggot who has killed Harvey Milk.
Who's that one, Mommy?
That's Moscone. He was a communist.
Was Harvey Milk a communist?
I don't know what he was. They were killed by Dan White. He was a fireman and a policeman.
And a murderer.
Don't say that. Dan White's a nice man.
Nice men don't go around killing people.
My kids will kill anyone who will harm them. I believe in violence. Goodbye.
She certainly has her opinions. That's one good thing.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8.
to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco has presented White Knight, Black Dish, or The Ultimate Last Fag Joke. Starring, in order of appearance, Bob Dylan, Judge Ollie Marie Victoire, Harvey Milk, Diane Feinstein, the fag nun Assunta Famia of the Sisters of Mercy and Vengeance, Dan White, an ex-cop, ex-fireman, and ex-supervisor, the Beatles, an ex-musical group, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, the Doors, Richard Nixon, an ex-president, Queen, Harry Britt, Larry Bensky, Fred Green, Earn Morgan Jr., Denise Dunn, Kern Chin, Terry Van Zandt, and William Tabbert. This is The Gay Life on KSAN for July 15th and 17th. Our guest this morning was fantasy and science fiction author Elizabeth A. Lynn. If you're listening on Sunday morning, this show will be repeated Monday night at 1 a.m. That's actually early Tuesday morning. The Gay Life is co-produced by Fred Green and Randy Alfred. That's me. The Gay Life will be heard next in 2 weeks on July 29th and 31st.
KSAN-FM, the sound of stereo. KSAN-FM, San Francisco, stereo.